Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Greetings from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is the September 15th, 2012 edition of Space Talk, live on the air right here on WMMB. Hey, we invite you to stick around with us during the next hour as we discuss our nation's space program, with the focus today on what NASA is doing to restore our capability of launching American astronauts into orbit using rockets made and launched from our own soil right here in the United States. Ed Mango from the Commercial Crew Program at Kennedy Space Center will be my guest today. Plus, we'll get you up to date with plans for Endeavour's departure from Florida on Monday, as well as when the next launch is from Cape Canaveral. You're always welcome to join us on the program. With your questions or comments about space, you can give us a call at 321-768-1240. Or if you're a little shy with the idea of being live on the air, well, then we invite you to contact us online. Just send an email to spacetalking@aol.com, and we'll see it on the screen here in the studio and love to have your input. I want to kick off today's discussion first by congratulating the United Launch Alliance team for their successful launch this past week from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. An Atlas rocket was launched on Thursday on a satellite delivery mission for the National Reconnaissance Office, and despite the ever-present fog at Vandenberg, the Atlas V launch did look pretty good. You know, I've had a few folks ask me about that this past couple of days. Why can they launch rockets in fog in California when clouds are such a concern here in Florida? Well, this mostly has to do with worries about something called rocket-triggered lightning here in Florida, which, of course, is the lightning capital of the United States. Clouds at certain heights or thicknesses and how those altitudes are related to the temperature of the air and where the freezing level is, and you combine all that with sort of what kind of general static charge is in the atmosphere in the first place. We put all those factors together, and often it can prevent a rocket from launching because of concerns of that the rocket's own exhaust will act like a lightning rod and trigger a bolt of lightning. That famously happened during the Apollo 12 mission in launch in 1969. Didn't cause any major problems. The mission continued safely, but it gave everyone a scare. Then in 1987, we lost an Atlas Centaur rocket from rocket-triggered lightning, and that greatly increased the awareness of the issue. Conditions at Vandenberg, though, however, due to kind of their local climate, are not as charged up, as it were, so they can, in fact, launch in fog. So that kind of answers the question, at least basically. In any case, all did go well. The Atlas V continues to rack up success after success as it maintains, its perfect record during the past 10 years. So good job, ULA. And with that, now let's offer for your consideration my more or less weekly broadcast blog, Orbital Inclinations. You know, we live in a world that some might describe as having a bipolar disorder. There seems to be two sides to everything. We're given choices between Coke or Pepsi, hamburgers or hot dogs, Target or Walmart, Vikings or Packers. But more seriously, we're also faced with good and evil, the rich and the poor, the living and the dying. And it seems that for every celebration of a first, we must mourn a last. Sometimes the sharp line between the highs and lows is blurred, and we encounter the wide range of possible experiences and emotions in a single moment. That's certainly the way I felt in watching the memorial service for Neil Armstrong last Thursday. And it is the way that I think I'm going to feel on Monday when we watch the Space Shuttle Endeavour depart the Kennedy Space Center for the last time. The service for Neil Armstrong at the National Cathedral was about as perfect and wonderful as you might hope and expect it to be for the first man to walk on the moon. All the right things were said, the music was appropriate, the scripture reading inspirational, and the setting was particularly beautiful, taking place in a facility considered the spiritual home of the nation, and in which there is a stained glass window that contains a moon rock retrieved from the lunar surface during Apollo 11. As I watched Apollo 17 Commander Gene Cernan speak of his friend Neil, I thought about the symbolism of the first and the last. Here was the last man to walk on the moon talking about the first. Here was a service rich in nostalgia for the accomplishments and boldness of our first era in space exploration, taking place during an era in space exploration that is by no means the last, but certainly pales in comparison to the glory days of Apollo. And now on Monday, those of us who call the Space Coast home will witness, experience, and endure another last that will call to mind an amazing record of firsts accomplished with the Space Shuttle Endeavor. On Monday, Endeavor is to be ferried to Los Angeles with a few stops along the way. The trip on top of NASA's 747 shuttle carrier aircraft will mark the last time an orbiter will take flight, the last time we'll see a space shuttle fly over our beaches, the last time the facilities used to support this kind of ferry flight will ever be used, and the last time this particular 747 will be flown before it is retired and stripped as a source of spare parts. I guess like death, it's in the inevitable end to a lifetime of historic contributions to our space program, itself assembled from spare parts following the 1986 Challenger disaster. Endeavor was named by school children, flew 25 missions, spent 296 days in space, and traveled 123 million miles, enough to make 247 round trips to the moon. Endeavor first launched from Florida Space Coast on May 7, 1992. Its maiden voyage, designated STS-49, was a daring satellite rescue mission that featured the first and only time to date that three astronauts had ventured outside for a spacewalk together, an improvised move, by the way, necessary to capture and repair a stranded Intelsat communications satellite with three pairs of gloved hands when the originally planned method with two spacewalkers failed. Endeavor also was the first ship to return to the Hubble Space Telescope in Earth orbit after it had been launched, hosting a critical servicing mission that repaired the telescope's blurry vision following a difficult time in which the nation's confidence in NASA needed restoring. NASA's newest orbiter also carried into orbit the first U.S. component of the International Space Station, the Unity Node, during a 1998 mission that was commanded by KSC's current Center Director, Bob Cabana. It also lofted eight other major parts of the space station, including Japan's scientific research module, Kaibo. Well, as we say goodbye to Endeavor on Monday, I know my heart will be filled with nostalgia for the accomplishments and boldness of a now lost era in space exploration. But it is by no means the last, but compared to the present situation, certainly compares to the glory days of the space shuttle. But if for every first, there is a last.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com. If it's happening in space, Jim Behnke is there. Okay, well, not in space, but he's all about it. This is Space Talk on WMMB.
Hey, welcome back, everyone, to Space Talk, 321-768-1240, the number to call to participate in the program. Send your questions or comments in an email to spacetalking@aol.com. My apologies in the first break there, first segment. There was a programming hitch here. We didn't exactly know what was going on, and suddenly we found ourselves off the air. We're back on now, and we will post our orbital inclinations online. We'll give you some instructions later on how to read the rest of what we had prepared for you today. But I don't want to waste any more time. Blame who you want. Whine and moan till you're red in the face. Complain bitterly about the short-sightedness of our presidents, the lack of vision from our Congress, or the plain ignorance and apathy of the American people in general. No, that isn't too overly pessimistic. But the fact of the matter is that for the next few years, this nation does not have the capability to launch its own astronauts into orbit. So in my opinion, let's not waste any more time looking back. Instead, let's look forward, solve the problem just as soon as it's safe to do so. We have a new space policy that looks to rely on a new way of doing business when it comes to putting American astronauts into orbit. And the NASA program that is overseeing that effort is based right here at the Kennedy Space Center, being run by a veteran space shuttle manager who knows a thing or two about safely launching people into space. And he's a nice guy to boot. Ed Mango is NASA's director of the Commercial Crew Program. He joins us by phone today from his home. Ed, welcome aboard. Glad to have you back on the show.
It's very good to be here, and good afternoon.
Well, good. Hey, so it has been a busy week for you in the commercial crew world. I don't want to get too much into the inside baseball details of everything that you did in the last 7 days, but you've had a hearing at Congress. One of your contractors, a big announcement, all sorts of, you put out another NASA research announcement. You've been busy.
Every week in commercial crew is busy, since we're trying to get U.S. crew back, transportation system, get U.S. crew back to space. And so, this last week was very busy. My boss in D.C., Bill Gerstenmaier, was able to brief Congress yesterday on the progress we're making and how we're moving forward. So that was very good. We also put out our request for proposal earlier in the week for our first phase of our certification effort for NASA certification. So things are going quite well.
Well, let's go to the high level here, and let's talk about what commercial crew is in general. Of course, with the retirement of the space shuttle, NASA is working on a new launcher, the Space Launch System. It's working on a new vehicle called Orion, to carry crew into space beyond Earth orbit. But in the meantime, we don't have a way to get people to and from the space station or to and from low Earth orbit. And so this new idea of turning to folks who have years of experience and some who are new to the game to get people into space, and that's kind of the birth pangs of the birth story of how commercial crew came about?
A number of years ago when it was realized that shuttle is not our going to be around after 2010, 2011. NASA decided to carry a two-prong approach, one for beyond low Earth orbit, which is far away from Earth. And, of course, Orion and the Space Launch System are doing that mission and getting ready to do that mission. That's an extremely hard mission, and NASA needs to be on every step. Our prong of the two-prong system is how to get folks to low Earth orbit. And that's, I wouldn't say an easy task whatsoever, but it is a task that NASA and other governments have been doing now for a number of years, especially NASA. And so we believe it's time to move some of that or a lot of that over to the private sector or to commercial industry and let them design and build vehicles, and eventually we'll buy services from those vehicles for NASA needs. And in the process, hopefully have a capability to go to other places in low Earth orbit and create capabilities throughout low Earth orbit for this transportation system. That's the whole premise of the Commercial Crew Program. It's a NASA government part of the program, is we provide funds to the table as well as expertise to the partners, and they provide some of their own funds, and then we work together as a really good partnership in order to develop those systems, and it's going quite well.
Well, we'll talk about the players and issues of safety in a moment. Let's talk about timelines right now. We sit out here with a couple of empty launch pads and you know, other activity going on at the Cape. When might we see commercial crew start flying?
I think that you will. We will see crew fly on vehicles probably, you know, from a NASA standpoint, we're thinking 2017 or earlier. Okay. And that's really for services. That's when we really start going to ISS and bringing our crew to ISS. From a testing standpoint, I believe that we will have test flights without crew and then with crew starting around 2015, and probably for the next 2 years after that, doing a number of different test flights. Again, some with crew and some without crew. And then by 2017, I think we'll be ready to go to the International Space Station with a crew that can stay on station for 6 months.
Well, I want to start talking about the players that are involved here, because I also have questions about who the crew is and how kind of this is all going to work. So let's start talking about, you're down to three contractors. I guess we can say two with full funding and one with half funding, but in any case, three companies getting money from NASA to develop their capability. Why don't you just go ahead and run down the list and who's involved?
Yeah, we back on August 3rd, we announced what we call CCICAP, which is Commercial Crew Integrated Capability. We awarded three awards to three different partners, and all three are moving their development systems from preliminary kind of design states to final design states with a number of tests in between. And so those three are the Boeing Company. Boeing Company has received or will could receive up to $460 million for the development of their CTS-100 capsule system, along with their launch vehicle, which they plan to use in Atlas V right here from the Cape.
Mm-hmm.
And then they also, of course, their mission ops and ground ops portions of that are also under that agreement to help develop those to the point where they are now ready to begin fabrication and construction. Second partner is SpaceX. SpaceX is out of California. And they are going to receive $440 million if they do all their milestones and do them successfully. And they also are going to be taking their Dragon vehicle that they use for cargo and converting that to a human capability system. They call, I think, a Dragon Rider. And they'll be able to fly that on their Falcon 9 vehicle, which they also are in the process of upgrading.
Mm-hmm.
And so that $440 million helps them with that effort. And our third partner is Sierra Nevada. Sierra Nevada is out of Colorado. And they're going to be receiving $212 million to take their Dream Chaser vehicle and continue to develop that vehicle in such a way that they can get into entry and landing tests. And they'll probably be doing that here. Actually, they're going to start that in December of this year in out in the Mojave Desert out at Edwards Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
They'll probably continue that throughout 2013. Once they have that done, then they'll finish their design work and then bring that here to Florida. And they are also going to launch on an Atlas V rocket right here from the Cape. And so all three of these companies are doing very good work on their designs and coming along to where all three will be flying right here out of the Cape.
Now let's go through them one more time. Boeing with the CST, which they got to come up with a more fun name than that at some point here. You know, you got to have the patch and the T-shirt. But it's a capsule. It looks a lot like Orion. It looks like a lot like an Apollo capsule in terms of its shape. I know the inside and the materials that it's made from is all new and modern and all of that. I won't use the dreaded quote from Dan Golden's era or anything, or Mike Griffin's era or anything. But the question that I've had people ask me, Ed, is that when they look at the CST-100 and they look at Orion, because they look so much alike, why do we need both is the question they ask. I think I know the answer, but I'd like to hear how you might describe it.
That's actually an excellent question. And it really comes to they have two different missions. And so the CTS-100 or any of our vehicles are really meant for low Earth orbit. In low Earth orbit, you're going about 17,500 miles per hour. You're going to stay on station for about 180 days and come back home. And so your entry and exit out of orbit is much different than if you're going way outside towards the moon, towards an asteroid, or towards Mars. It's coming back home, now you're coming at over 25,000 miles per hour. Plus, you have to provide all the capability you need for that entire mission through either the Orion vehicle or something attached to it, versus our vehicle is really an ability to get four crew on a two-day mission to station and a 1 to 2 day mission away from station to come back home. And so the missions are very different. It's like taking a Ford Focus versus taking a Ford Explorer, and it's or even better, might be like taking a Ford Focus or a vehicle that can really go far and have a comfortable ride, which is what Orion is doing. Ours is much more of you got to run around planet Earth, you got to get to a location, take care of some business, come back, more like a commuter kind of deal for space.
Yeah, I know as a guy who just this week turned in his van for a new little hybrid car, you know, we don't need the big cargo long trip carrying capability anymore. We just need a way to get to 7-Eleven and back, you know?
That's true. Of course, 7-Eleven in space, you know, I won't equate that to our space station, but it is a much quicker trip, and you just got to bring the folks there and their research and bring them back home.
Now, Sierra Nevada, of course, is we don't know a lot about them historically. You know, I mean, Boeing's name is all over the place. We've certainly heard a lot about SpaceX here at the Cape in the last few years and this year especially. Sierra Nevada, kind of a new company in that sense. They've got this lifting body concept. They've got something that looks more or less like a small little space shuttle that would launch like a rocket, land like an airplane, as you alluded to with drop tests at Mojave.
with everything you need to know about America's space program, here is Jim Behnke.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to what I think is our second half of Space Talk on WMMB. It's becoming one of those weird days. I knew the Vikings winning last week was probably too good to be true, so I'm getting punished for it today. Basically, what's happening here is that the program that runs the computer that runs the radio station has everything laid out for us like normal, but for some reason is jumping into commercials and what we call the blocks, you know, the spot blocks for the advertisements and whatnot at weird times. Generally, where the breaks are supposed to be, but not quite at the normal time. So. We're still trying to figure out all that. We may just suddenly jump off the air again and have another commercial for you and then be back. But over the course of the hour here, we're going to get it all in one way or the other. And today, on that topic, we're talking today with Ed Mangle from NASA's Commercial Crew Program Office based at the Kennedy Space Center. Ed's on the phone with us and during it as well. And, Ed, thanks for sticking with us. Glad to have you with us again.
It's good to be back.
Yeah. Hey. Okay. So we were talking about Sierra Nevada and their lifting body, sort of their mini space shuttle concept. And the question I wanted to ask you was, are they going to do? You mentioned the tests at Mojave. Are those the tests kind of like we did with Enterprise and the shuttle, where they're going to drop it, they glide it down to a landing, and then will they eventually do an orbital entry and landing kind of a deal, unmanned or manned? How would that work? Do you know?
Let's see, for what we have with agreement today with them is they're going to begin the drop similar to what we did with Enterprise. At first, they're going to be dropping it really from a helicopter that can get high enough to do the final approach and landing.
Yeah.
And so they'll be doing that starting in December to probably have a few free flight tests from that point. And all those tests are unmanned.
Okay.
And they're really on a system that looks like a Dream Chaser, but it's called an engineering test article. So we call it an ETA for short, since
sure.
Everything has to be an acronym. And that, of course, that can't really hold people, but it will have some of the software that we probably will be using in the future, and very much some of the guidance and navigation subsystems that we'll be using in the future.
Sure.
And so it's really to test out that, as well as to test out how the lifting capability of the vehicle is as compared to the wind tunnel tests that we've been running with them over the last couple of years. So it's very similar to Enterprise, except to be unmanned at first. I think Sierra's plans are eventually to have a crewed vehicle that would also do approach and landing tests, very similar to what we did with Enterprise. And that will probably come in the next couple of years. And eventually they will have to take that system and put it in orbit, probably uncrewed first, and then eventually crewed, and go through the entire mission cycle and, again, bringing it to a landing. Eventually, they have told us they would like to land at Kennedy, right there on the landing strip at Kennedy,
sure.
Just like the shuttles used to do. Of course, you don't want to do that too early, because you want to make sure that you can get to a runway, and if there's any issues, you have lots of lake bed to land on, and that's why they're going to do the first ones right there at Edwards, like shuttle did.
Yeah, 15,000-foot concrete strip versus a 20-mile-long, 7-mile-wide piece of flat clay. I know what I'd choose first.
Yeah,
so,
very true.
So, okay, so now this raises the question that I wanted to ask you earlier. When you talk about these vehicles flying with people on board, and especially in the case of Sierra Nevada's Dream Chaser, where, you know, you think, you know, you're going to need a pilot unless this is all remotely operated, who are going to crew these things? Who are going to be? I mean, you're going to have a deal where, you know, one guy's the commander pilot and he's somebody that. Oh, and we're hearing bumper music already. Well, that's interesting. The question is going to be, who's the astronauts flying? Is it NASA astronauts, or are NASA astronauts become the cargo when the thing flies? Ed, I'm not sure what's going to happen here in another 6 seconds, but we may either be coming back.
It'll be a combination of both, and
yeah.
We can explain more when we have an opportunity.
Yeah, let's see here. So, okay, so that was exciting. We heard bumper music, but we didn't go anywhere. Okay, so... So when these guys are going to fly, again, who's the commander? Is it a SpaceX employee, a Boeing employee, taking three guys up to the space station and then taking them back? Do we know how that's going to work yet?
Yeah, I think we're working through that. NASA is open to any of those solutions, and it's probably similar to how the DOD, the Air Force, as well as the Navy, does development of their new fighter jets. where, you know, the companies make the fighter jets, and the first people to fly the fighter jets are usually right from the company.
Right.
Kind of encourages the company to make sure they're going to work right from the beginning. And so I kind of like that model because it says, and the company is fully engaged, and they have one of their employees or two of their employees flying the vehicle for the first time. And therefore, it's their risk that they're taking against their employees. After our first few flights of that, not even to station, then we'll start incorporating probably NASA folks on the next couple flights after that. And this is for any of the providers that we end up with. And, of course, at that point, we really need to be certified towards the NASA requirements, our technical requirements, our safety requirements. And so all that has to happen really in parallel with eventually flying any crew, and then especially flying the NASA crew that we eventually will buy services for. So in the end, we're probably open to either, whether or not a NASA pilot is flying the vehicle or is one of the four passengers that we have to get to station is really up to the companies and really up to the business model as well as the technical operational model that any of the companies really want to use. Because bringing extra people to station, once we are operational, is somehow we got to make sure we have enough food and water and capability for those extra individuals when they do get to station. Sure. So that's a whole other problem we have to work if there's more than just the four people on board.
Now, of course, safety is a big deal here when you're dealing commercial. A lot is being made of it. There's political motivations and business motivations here, people that have a problem with it, people that are for it. You know, I personally think, Ed, that if you lay out the certification, if you lay out and say, as NASA, where you're going to be your customer and you better meet these needs, you better meet these qualifications, these certifications, or we're not going to buy from you, it's pretty clear that, you know, it's going to be safe. They're not going to go sneak something in on you. I know it's a lot more complicated than that, but could you sort of talk about how you're going to deal with the safety and how that kind of works with the way these contracts work?
Absolutely. Now that we're beginning phase one of our certification effort, which, like I said, we kicked off just the other day by putting out the RFP, in the end, our safety requirements will have to be met. And when they are met, then we will certify that that vehicle can fly our astronauts. Those safety requirements are owned, operated, dealt with by NASA. And so if a company does not meet those, then they must come to NASA, and we will talk about it and see if there's options. But most of the time, we're going to say you need to meet these requirements. Otherwise, we'll go find another provider, another capability. So that's it in the bottom line. You know, and I was in the firing room for Challenger, and I walked the many miles in East Texas after Columbia.
Yeah.
So I know personally what it means to have people that are friends that you lose. And my commitment, not only to the political folks of the nation, but also to the astronauts who I will be flying someday, is that I will do everything in my power to make sure that does not happen with the right acquisition, the right technical experts on my team, and the way that we're going to approach getting ready to go fly, and then during the flight, trying to help making sure that if we get in any kind of trouble, it's trouble we can recover from and get our crew home safely.
Yeah.
That's my commitment and my whole team's commitment to the astronauts who fly in this thing, the American public, and the folks that represent us both in Congress and in the White House.
Yeah, and I think the way the contracts are being written, this business about whether you have oversight versus insight, how much control you have over every last little process. I mean, I personally, I think it's time for the system to evolve, and for this purpose of putting astronauts to and from low Earth orbit, you know, this is the right way to go. You know, now if this evolves to the point where we eventually have a shuttle bus to the moon, well, then we'll expand that capability as well. I mean, I think there's so many parallels with aviation on this that sometimes is not the right way to look at it, but so many places it is. And when you consider, just as you said, you know, in terms of like the test pilots and the guys that fly the thing first, I mean, I just think this is the way to go. I think one of the other big things that's interesting to me about this, of course, is that the commercial crew program is based here at Kennedy Space Center. And again, I don't want to get too inside baseball on this, but for the history of NASA, for the history of the Space Center, that was a huge deal to have a major program like that based here at Kennedy, especially when you're dealing with humans flying on space. Everyone wants to look at Houston, yet we're here doing the work here. And I wish you could just, if you could, talk a little bit about the importance of this program to KSC and how it fits into the history and culture of our agency.
Absolutely. I am thrilled that the program is right here at the Kennedy Space Center. It is, I don't know if it's a dream come true, but it certainly is a great opportunity for Kennedy to show the the NASA community as well as the world that we are capable of running such a big program that's really about human safety.
Yeah.
Of course, there's a lot of folks in the program that are from Houston, and so I like to think of the program, even though it's headquartered here in Florida, and I have a great team, I'm also getting folks from throughout the agency and in Houston to help make sure the program is successful, because no one place can do it alone. And so I have a lot of help from other centers. Now, being here at Kennedy, it is, from the history of Kennedy, this is the first human space flight program that is here at Kennedy. And so it's a great history to remember John F. Kennedy by. He's the one who said, let's go to the moon and come back. And we did that. And now, in his legacy, we can look at creating a capability to get to low Earth orbit and leave it there and use that capability probably for 10 to 20, maybe even 40 years from now.
Yeah.
We fly in these systems that we're developing today.
I just think it's, you know, of course it involves all the other centers, just like the shuttle program based in at Johnson involves people here. Curiosity at JPL, you still got to launch a thing from here, and communications networks and all that at the other places. I just think it's great that so often in the history of KSC, people come here, launch their rocket, and leave. And I just think it's great that a program is here. And there's certainly economic benefits to that there are staff here, that there's workers here supporting the program in terms of the front office and all of that. And I think that's really great. Now, what's the next step for you in terms of commercial crew? You mentioned the certification. I guess we're going to take a break here, Ed. We will take a break, so stand by. And then when we come back, we'll finish our conversation with Ed Mango, Commercial Crew Office at the Kennedy Space Center, helping us get astronauts back into space on American rockets. And when we come back, we're going to wrap up our conversation. Plus, we'll take a quick look at the weekly launch forecast and get you up to date on what's happening with Space Shuttle Endeavour's departure from the Space Center on Monday. So that's what's ahead. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back in just a moment. I'm Jim Bank. You're listening to Space Talk on WMMB.
Now, back to our own mission specialist, Jim Bankey.
And welcome back as we begin our final segment of today's edition of Space Talk. A quick reminder, you can stay in touch with us online throughout the week. Your first stop, WMMBAM.com, keyword Space Talk, where you can find an archive of past Space Talk shows, archive of our orbital inclinations. You can also follow us on Twitter at Space Talking, and there is a Space Talk page on Facebook as well. Your questions and comments always welcome online throughout the week. Let's take a quick moment, look at the local launch forecast while we think we're still on the air and see what's on the calendar. Coming up in just under 3 weeks on what will be the 55th anniversary of the world's first satellite launch, Sputnik, in this case, the United Launch Alliance Delta IV rocket is scheduled to blast off from Cape Canaveral Air Force Station. The Delta IV will be carrying the newest GPS navigation satellite into Earth orbit. We know we can't get along without those, and is targeted for launch at 8:10 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time on Thursday, October 4th. Again, just under 3 weeks from now. And while it's not a launch, we should note that the three of the current crew members on board the space station right now scheduled to return to Earth on their Soyuz spacecraft tomorrow night. Gennady Padalka, Sergey Revin, and NASA's Joe Acaba, who, as you may remember, once taught science across the street from the studio here at Melbourne High School, are to undock from the station at 7:09 p.m. Eastern, and then touch down in Kazakhstan a couple hours later, 10:53 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. This will clear the way for the next crew to launch to the space station October 15th. And, of course, don't forget that Space Shuttle Endeavour will depart KSC atop its 747 carrier jet at about 7 a.m. on Monday. The duo will make the traditional low pass over much of the space coast, up and down the beaches and then slightly inland and then head west. We'll be out at the runway for the departure, and I will be calling into Bill Mick live to let folks know when the 747 is taken off. You might be able to head outside and have your chance to see Endeavour's flyout. Again, for more information about this and all the various launches scheduled around the world, jump on the web to WMMBAM.com, keyword Space Talk, and look for the link to our launch forecast. On the phone with us for just a few more moments, Ed Mango, Director of the Commercial Crew Program at Kennedy Space Center, a NASA-wide program going to return our astronauts to space on an American spacecraft, an American vehicle. Ed, when will you be making the next down? I mean, I assume ultimately, are you going with one contractor? Are you going to be able to have two competing? How far down do you take this winnowing process?
Well, let's see. From a competition standpoint, I like to go as long as we can with more than one. Obviously, budget drives some of that. So, and once you go down to one, you're kind of set on price.
Yeah.
And so, competition is always good. I think at this point we have our three ICAP folks that we're working with. The next round, phase one of the certification contract that we should award in February of next year, we'll probably have a multiple group of companies that can do that work. It's really a lot of discussion about safety requirements. Safety hazards, verification activities that each company plans to do, and then overall what their certification plan is. And because it's this contract, that means we can help drive those solutions. And then phase two will pick up in the summer or spring or summer of 2014, and that will really take one, if not two, contractors all the way through certification. So that's all the work that has to be done for certification, the fabrication of the test vehicles, the actual doing of all the tests, to buy off the verifications, to buy off that is the vehicle really ready to go fly, mm-hmm. and then eventually a whole series of activities that got to lead to a number of reviews that NASA will then say, yes, this vehicle is ready to fly our astronauts, and then we'll put our crew on board and go fly. And I expect that to be sometime probably second half of 2015 and or 2016, according to the companies. I'm prepared to go as long as 2017 if we need to, because developing new space hardware is never easy, and you got to give yourself some margin. So that's why I would like to be done as early as possible, but I'm really thinking that we can hold the program to 2017 and still make the goals of the program.
Yeah, and of course, the sooner the better, obviously, for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is the future of the space station past 2020, where it's currently baselined. Personally, again, I think that that's an incredible facility up there that I can't see anybody abandoning anytime sooner than it needs to. Ed, we talk about the space station as a goal, but there's always this other phrase, you've used it earlier, about other possibilities, other destinations, other activities we could be doing in low Earth orbit. Have you identified any of those? Have you envisioned anything else that we should be doing in low Earth orbit besides just taxiing back and forth?
Absolutely. We hope Commercial Crew hopes to provide a transportation system. And right now we have a destination of ISS, an unbelievable research facility that is now starting to do some really good research. And hopefully that research will go on for the next 8 years, if not even longer, and that's what we're really driving towards. In the process, as soon as the commercial industry, that not necessarily the aerospace industry, but maybe pharmaceutical companies and material companies start looking at what you can get done out of low Earth orbit, then there'll probably be another host of space activities, maybe even kind of space stations in orbit to go work on that kind of commercialization. Very similar to, again, what happened with the airlines when the government did airmail and eventually turned it over. And as we turned it over, those capabilities for flying mail became an unbelievable airline system within the next 15 to 20 years.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what we think we're at the infancy of doing today. And 10 years from now, we'll have not only a NASA need, but also these other commercial needs. Besides, there's probably other government agencies that need access to low Earth orbit and some of these vehicles with humans on board. And some of these vehicles might be able to use that. Humans in the loop are always a great asset to bring to the table when budgets are tight and you need to go figure out how to repair something or service something in orbit versus having to replace it and having the entire cost of a whole new system to get launched in orbit. So I think in the next 10 years we will see a ballooning of activities that could be done with humans in the loop in space, and then I think our transportation systems that we're developing will be able to carry that through.
Well, I think even just what they can do to supply services to NASA, these other companies, again, might see a market materialize, and and the help they have in getting far enough along in the development of their vehicles to go make a go of it on their own would be a great thing, too, for our space program, not just NASA, but for our entire nation's ability to become a spacefaring nation even more so than it is today.
Yep, I would like someday to not have a Southwest Airlines, but have some type of space line
that
the nation and the planet can use.
We'll start building the terminal right now at the end of the SLF. That would
be great. Good.
Hey, Ed, thanks so much for spending time with us today. I appreciate it. You're a good friend, good guy, and good luck with everything. And, again, I'm just grateful you're the man at the top doing the work. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, and have a great afternoon.
You too. Talk to you soon, Ed. Okay, bye-bye. Okay, there goes Ed Mango, Commercial Crew Program Director. Hey, in just a couple of moments here left, I wanted to share with you the very end of Neil Armstrong's memorial service, the final words, and I was going to include these as part of my orbital inclinations. I just think it's great words to live by, and so let me share them with you quick. The final blessing was this: go forth into the world in peace. Search the cosmos. It is the Lord's. And may the God of all strength nerve you with the courage of the astronauts. Behold the face of Christ in your neighbor, and the blessing of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit be upon you, go before you, and surround you now and always. What a great prayer to end Neil Armstrong's service with, and great words to live by as we again continue to work on the future of our space program. Next week, Space Talk will be my old friend, former boss, Elliot Pullum of the Space Foundation. He recently toured Peenemünde in Germany, the home of the V-2 missile, which led to many things here at the Kennedy Space Center. We're going to talk to him about that. It'll be a great show. That's it for now. Space Talk, a production of Mylas Solutions, brought to you thanks to the help of our supporting sponsors, Space Florida, Boeing, Abacus Technology, SpaceX, United Launch Alliance, and Lockheed Martin. Thanks to Sean Williams for picking up the pieces in today's program. We kept it going. Please join us next Saturday at 2 p.m. Eastern Daylight for another hour of Space Talk. Stay tuned now. WMB has the weekend edition of Glenn Beck. I'm Jim Behnke. Hey, we'll talk to you Monday morning with Endeavor's departure. See you then.